Good evening, good citizens. I'm your host, Clifford Brooks, and this is Dante's Old South. I won't waste time with a long hello, but I do want you to know that if you want to know more about our guests, go online and look up our journal of culture, the Blue Mountain Review. The Blue Mountain Review is read by over 700,000 folks nationwide, and it covers life lived well and creative writing in all genres. Now, before we get started, I want to give a shout out to a few folks. This thank you goes to Lucid House Publishing, a press devoted to representing all voices with style, beauty, and grace. The Red Phone Booth, swanky speakeasies in Georgia, Texas, and Tennessee. The Crown Restaurant, a gluten-free paradise located in beautiful Brasstown, North Carolina, just around the corner from the John C. Campbell Folk School. Thank you to Mercer University Press, a press with over 50 years of quality authors under their belt. And UCLA Writers Extension Program, offering courses in all disciplines to help you get ahead in the industry of creating writing. Then we have NPR and WUTC for a decade of belief and support of this program. And last but not least, we have Richard Whittem and Michael Amade, my producers and leaders in radio that have allowed me to sound so good for you. Now, with all that aside, let's get started with this month's Dante's Old South. And now on Dante's, we have Emmy-nominated comedy writer for Jay Leno and Jimmy Fallon, a screenwriter and screenwriter instructor for the UCLA Extension Writers Program. We have here for you tonight, Mr. Michael Jan. Michael, how are you doing, boss?
Good. Fantastic. I'll ignore the fact that it looks light outside, and we'll go with tonight.
All right. That's as much as I can ask, boss. I always, and they've heard me on this show say this a lot, but I love to begin at the beginning. So who is Michael Jan?
Who is Michael Jan? Yeah, what the hell do I do all day? I am a comedy writer, and that's a good and a bad thing. It makes me think of the most inappropriate thing to say at all times, which either gets a laugh or a slap. And I write, it's sad. Most of my friends are imaginary. I sit at a laptop hearing and talking to characters and trying to make sure it's a good fight, like an Ali Frazier fight, and not one of those ones where Mike Tyson destroys someone in 3 seconds.
I love the technical side of things with screenwriting and comedy writing. You know, people hit the high notes as far as like who was the funniest, you know, what's your favorite memory. I love the nuts and bolts of how you got there. So for those who are looking to make what you do a vocation, what's some of the technical knowledge you can give them?
Well, do you mean in terms of how I got into the business, how I got where I am, or do you mean actual joke writing kind of thing? Probably the former, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I think my path is it helps to start off as a really shy, insecure kid who thinks that he shouldn't open his mouth unless it's good, unless it's funny. So that's who I was, and I think I was funny and trying to overcome my shyness. And I was at the University of Connecticut studying to be a veterinarian, of course. And I had a funny idea for a column for the school paper. I thought, wouldn't it be great if there was an advice column, kind of like a Dear Abby thing, but giving the worst advice imaginable. So I started making up questions and problems that my fellow students might have, and then speaking authoritatively on the worst possible advice and solution. And I did this, and everybody liked it. People were laughing. People were reading the school paper and laughing. And I remember like walking across campus, seeing a couple read the paper and be laughing. And I wanted to tap them on the shoulder and say, "That's me. I wrote that." But you sort of can't. And that's the life of a comedy writer. You're behind the scenes. You know, Jay would go out on stage or Jimmy Fallon and tell the joke. And I would know I kind of helped with that joke. Mm-hmm. Nobody else. But then I think the magic moment for me was on campus one day. I ran up the steps of the student union. You know those life moments you never forget? Ran up the steps with my latest column, you know, say three or four letters and answers. And I just stopped at the top step. And I looked around and I thought, I am not being paid for this. I am not getting a grade for this. And here I am running to this. I think this is what I want to do for a living. And so goodbye vet school and hello to comedy writing. And then I achieved it in a mere 10 years.
Just a 10-year overnight success, right?
Yeah, I went into advertising because that was the cool thing to do. You know, it's like I thought I'll be a writer. I'll be a creative writer and be paid. And how long could that take? A month or a few months? And 10 years later, I got hired by Jay Leno as he took over The Tonight Show for Johnny Carson. And then I went on the 23-year run with them the whole way. And it's just it went by in a flash because it was so fun and so great. And then hooked up with Jimmy Fallon as he took over for The Tonight Show. And that was fun. Wasn't as fun because in that case, I was emailing jokes to New York as opposed to being at The Tonight Show in Burbank, which is a blast. I mean, if you ever get to work on something like The Tonight Show, I remember... the San Diego Zoo would bring in animals sometimes. Yeah. One day I got to pet a baby tiger. I got to pet a reindeer and I got to pet Cindy Crawford. That was just one great day.
That leads me into, I mean, you mentioned it before, but I want the latter as well. What are some of the tricks of the trade of joke writing? I just can't let that one go, man.
Okay, joke writing is it's a really specific skill that it's different than you have to resist the urge to just be a comedian and pick a viewpoint and hit it. You're trying to find the joke that no one else in the room would think of. And so what you do is you make a long list. Like you take the two things, this is get kind of wonky, right? But you take the two words in a joke because a story's not in the newspaper unless it's got two discordant things. You know, the old thing is dog bites man is not a story, but man bites dog, that's a story. Well, every story in the news has something like that made somebody say, hey, this is newsworthy. You find those two things and you make a long list underneath each of those nouns, let's say. And you're not looking for a joke. You're just looking for what's everything I can think of under the word kitten, okay? And you get about, don't stop until you do 10 of them. And then you do, in the other word, the story in the news was a kitten got thrown in the washing machine, okay? This was the actual story. A kitten survived a 45-minute spin cycle in a washing machine. So I write down everything I can think of under washing machine, and I'm not trying to be funny. I'm just writing a list. And then I saw the connection. I saw this oblique tangential line. I connected them together. The joke is this woman in Wisconsin was washing, doing her laundry. And when it came time to get the clothes out of the washer and put them into the dryer, she saw something move. Her 3-week-old kitten had somehow fallen into the washer and somehow survive. Now, they think there's a chance the kitten might live. They don't know yet. He's still in the dryer. It's got about 10 more. It's a good joke, but the only way I got was that long list where I saw the word dryer, and I just thought, well, she's putting stuff from the washer to the dryer. Maybe that's where the kitten is. And so that's joke writing. You work hard until you see something that no one else expected. And the thing is, most of that joke, as I told it, now I'm trying to take you away from the punchline. I'm trying to head fake. It's all head fake. I'm trying to get you to think that I really care and that, oh my goodness, I would never want anything bad to happen to a kitten. The kitten may or may not live. I've got you way over there. Then I come right back to where the joke started and you burst out.
Well, springboarding off this good humor, I want to know what other good humor you have on deck. Do you have any projects coming up which we should know about?
Yes. My wife is my writing partner. My wife, Michelle, and I write screenplays, mostly rom-coms. But right now, we have a couple of rom-coms that we're writing and having fun about. But the coolest project is this short animated film that we made. We actually made the short film. It's a story about a mosquito who faints at the sight of blood. And her name is Citronella. So she just can't get a break. So we thought, what if we make a short film about this to show the studios what it could be? And the idea my wife came up with was, what if Citronella, this mosquito, is trying to get up the nerve to go to therapy for the first time? Bug therapy. What if the bug therapy group is run by a pill bug named Dr. Pill? And Dr. Phil is in the movie. Megan Trainor is Citronella. Jay Leno plays a fly who can't stop washing his hands. Because you know, flies roll through that. Hey, you don't know what these hands have done. And Sterling K. Brown, ridiculous actor from This Is Us, he plays a stick bug who he's depressed because he feels like no one sees him. It's like kind of moving.
Yeah, yeah.
Tom Green is in it as a grasshopper who is addicted to coffee. He likes it, but it makes him jumpy, and he keeps leaving the movie. We've got a spider who's afraid of spiders. And then we've got my wife and I play the dysfunctional dragonfly couple. You know how two dragonflies are always on top of me? It's like, just get off me, but I love you. So we made the short film. It turned out pretty good. Has not turned into a feature film yet. And I blame my wife. Her writing, my half was good.
Right.
I blame her. No, really what I think is we need to write the perfect feature script for Bug Therapy. Maybe the title isn't Bug Therapy. Maybe it's something else, but we think we have an idea here. We have a heck of a sizzle reel. You can see it on bugtherapy.film if you want to see it.
No.
9 minutes long, and it's kind of fun.
All right. Michael Jan, before we let you go, do you have a funny story from your comic writing days or your career in general you'd like to drop on us?
Yeah, I think my least favorite moment, so I'll share that, least favorite moment of my career is... There was a time when Jay was, you know, in the process of wrangling about the Tonight Show. Would he keep it or would Conan O'Brien get it? If you remember all that drama.
I do.
And we had a 3-month hiatus during which that drama was settled. And we got the news, all right, come back to work. Jay's the host of the Tonight Show. Jay's on the cover of Time Magazine and the King of Late Night and... all the writers are gathered in the writer's room, right? After this 3-month hiatus, we're all happy to be there. Personally, for me, I'm kind of scared in that I have recently divorced and I remarried very quickly, very foolishly, and it didn't work out, had to get an annulment. And I felt like kind of like a fool, and I'm in a place where they make fun of people for a living. So I'm afraid, and I'm saying to myself, you know what? Nobody cares. It's okay. So Jay walks into the meeting and everybody's excited and he sits down at the head of the table. He's on the cover of Time Magazine and he says, listen, before we get started, I just want to say, while we were gone, Mike Jan got married 3 more times. And the whole room erupts. And I'm like,
that's awesome.
The King of Late Night is telling Mike Jan jokes. And there was nowhere to hide. And I think that helped me get over it. Like, there's nowhere to hide. You are who you are. And your mess, hopefully people will like you more for it than if you were perfect. And so that's kind of like a good story and a life lesson, I think, for me.
And I would love to end on that. But before we do, tell us how we can keep up with you personally and about this film you got going, bro.
Keep up with me. You can email me and my wife. If you're a woman who's lusting after me, it's too bad because I'm married. Michelle's going to see the email first. MJ2@bugtherapy.film. We both have the initials MJ. MJ2@bugtherapy.film. And you can see this fun 9-minute film. We put it on YouTube for free for National Mental Health Awareness Month. It was actually last May, and 500,000 people watched it in a hurry. So we decided to leave it up, and we continue to work every day on coming up with a better script. So if you want to get in touch with me, that's the email. Watch the film, and for God's sake, listen to Clifford's show. It's fantastic.
Thank you, Mike. And what they don't find here about you, they're going to find in the next Blue Mountain Review that's coming out soon with Billy Bob Thornton on the cover. So,
wow.
Yeah. Michael Jan, it's been fantastic to have you on, and we're going to have you back on soon.
How come I'm not on the cover?
And so let's get to the tune called Dear Me by Tay Lewis.
Dear me, it won't always be easy. The world's waiting to see who you are. There'll be voices of doubt. When you figure it out, believe it with all your heart. So take a breath and hold on tight. It gets better as the days go by. So keep on dreaming and never let go. Keep on running and never lose hope. Now this race is a distance, but you gotta promise me you'll keep fighting. Yeah. Dear me, just be who you are, 'cause one day it'll work out. There's a price that you pay when you want it your way. So believe it with all of your heart.
It is an honor and a pleasure to have up now on Dante's poet and professor, January Gill O'Neill. January, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much. This is great.
It's beautiful to have you on, and I want people to know everything about you at your speed. So to help folks do that, tell me a little bit or a lot of it about you.
I am a poet and professor. I teach at Salem State University in Massachusetts, Salem, home of the witches. And I've been in Massachusetts for about 20 years, but I am a Virginia native. And as we record this, I'm in my mother's house in Virginia going to do a reading in a few days at Norfolk State. So it was a good time to come down and visit her. My kids are at school and they're college age, and I'm thankful that we are there so I can get out of the house a little bit. But I'm really enjoying promoting my book, Glitter Road. It's my fourth collection. Even if I didn't have a book, I would just, you know, enjoy, you know, writing and being with people and being part of the poetry community, which I think overall has a big heart. And it's fun to watch my friends and colleagues and new writers, you know, just sort of bloom. I've often said that this is probably the best time to publish because there are so many options and opportunities, and you know, the money is not quite there and the visibility is not there, but just even on a local level, to be able to share with your friends and neighbors, I think is so, so important.
Well, you've already mentioned your new book. Tell us more about it, especially, you know, why this book is different from your others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and especially let's focus on the joy aspect of it.
Sure. So Glitter Road is my fourth collection. It came out in February, and I have had so much fun just showing it off. We don't have a copy in front of us, but it has a beautiful cover with gold foil on. And the cover is the map of the one of the meander maps for the Mississippi River. In 2019, I won a fellowship to the University of Mississippi, Oxford. So I was down there for an academic year. So I took my teenagers at the time, and I'm a single parent, so I had to move them from Massachusetts to Mississippi. And it was quite the adventure. And much of the book takes place in Mississippi. I had never been to Mississippi. I call it the South South. I mean, I'm from Virginia, but and spent time in Georgia, but like this felt different. Mainly, mostly good different, but we did hit a few moments that gave us pause. Before we went down, there was a photo that went viral of three boys who were Ole Miss students standing next to the shot up sign, the shot up marker for Emmett Till. Emmett Till being a 14-year-old boy who was beaten and shot and thrown into the Tallahatchie River for reportedly whistling at a white woman. These boys stood next to the sign and posed, as if they were proud, with their rifles. And that photo went viral. That happened before we went down. We were also watching what happened to this giant 30-foot statue on the grounds of the University of Mississippi. It had been there for about 100 years. The community wanted it down, and the college was slow to respond. And then we were also watching what was happening with the removal of the Confederate flag over the state capitol and in Mississippi. So the Stars and Bars, the last state with the Confederate flag, which both the statue and the flag were removed in 2020. But we were going down in 2019. We were, you know, rightfully concerned. We didn't know what we were going to walk into. But I'm happy to say that it was, being down there was a rewarding experience. I mean, everybody I met in Oxford and beyond Oxford, you know, was terrific and helpful and caring. And it was just a reminder that there are good people everywhere. I think we all want the same things. We all want to raise our kids and have them go on and do big things. We want to find work that fulfills us. You know, we want to connect with our neighbors, and that was certainly true. So for somebody who's lived a good portion of their life in New England, I was, you know, it was a good reminder that we have to get out of our bubble sometimes.
We, off camera, so to speak, before we started this interview, we really, again, I to touch back on joy. With the show and with what I do, I always loved Ray Laughter, because when people laugh, you got them, you got their attention, they're not worried, you've added levity. In the tumultuous times we've just talked about, how do you maintain that joy within your poetry?
Well, in the case of this book, Most of it was written, well, a good portion was written before the pandemic. After the pandemic, we really had to look for joy. I mean, we weren't connecting and you couldn't meet up with people. I mean, my pandemic purchase was a bird feeder, and I can only write so many bird poems. Who wants to read that? Not even me. But even when we were in Mississippi, so we went down in August 2019, you know, we found ways to connect. But part of it was staying open, too. And I believe this, whether it's then or now, it takes a lot to try to see the world anew, to find something different that you hadn't seen before. And so, you know, you can look at that same cardinal under the bird feeder, and the craft, or the flex, if you will, is to see that bird and connect it to something else. Find something new about this creature and how it connects to you and how you connect to the rest of the world. I can't say that I do that every time I walk out of the house. You know, life throws us too many distractions, but it's certainly worth it, especially in these times, which, you know, feel unsettled, you know, not just nationally, but globally. So to try to remember and hold on to a piece of ourselves and go maybe inside and let that flourish and bloom. For me, it comes out in poetry. For others, it might be knitting. It might be cooking. It might be music or whatever connects them to the deepest part of themselves. That's how I look for joy. I can't say I do it consciously, but sometimes you really have to be deliberate in your actions. Otherwise, I mean, what's the alternative? I mean, curl up in a ball and rock myself on the couch, I guess.
And we've seen enough sad movies about that.
Yeah.
In the Blue Mountain Review, you'll be in next month in April of 2024. We talk about your approach to editing, but I'm going to ask you a different way of that. Like, how do you know when a poem of yours is done?
Mm-hmm. I can feel that in the body. And it's usually when I've learned something about myself that I didn't know before. And that feels like a really great thing. It means that I have been working towards something that I didn't know. And I think it's important to surprise yourself. I mean, if you can't surprise yourself in your work, then, you know, what will your readers find? I mean, I've gotten to the end of my poem sometimes, you know, maybe some of the bird poems, and had that so what feeling. Oh, I saw a bird today. Okay, that's great. But at some point, the poem has to transition. And so if it doesn't happen on the first draft, because I try to sit down and finish it, you know, whether it's 10 minutes or an hour, I try to get as far as I can. If I go back to revise it, then I'm looking to see if there's something I can salvage, something I can work towards. And that's the craft. I don't really like revision, but it is a necessary evil. I mean, revision can be painful. And I have to sit there and make myself, you know, not check my phone, not clean the grout around the bathtub. You know, I'll do anything to get out of it. But being present means butt in chair, work through this, keep going. And that is really sometimes the hardest thing to do.
A lot of people, poets especially, we write so much in solitude that when they get on stage to perform it, they either clam up or read too fast or too monotonous. And, you know that something beautiful is happening, but you're either bored into a slumber or it's so fast that your nose bleeds. How do you approach, now that you're on tour with your new book, how do you approach the stage when you perform your poetry?
It probably took me to my, you know, third book and actually being in front of the classroom to get over, you know, a little bit of stage fright and nervousness. You know, teaching taught me that I really do know more in the moment than what the students know. So I was able to sort of take that out. But I started out just as rough as everyone else does and nervous and not looking up and just trying to get off stage as quickly as possible, you know, reading quickly, you know. But as I've gotten older and more mature, I tend to read the audience. You know, I pick my poems, you know, I don't decide weeks in advance. The night of the event, I go into the venue. And I look and see, you know, what the audience is like. You know, I certainly don't want to read risque poems to students because that doesn't seem appropriate. And, You know, and then so, you know, you want to get a feel for what kind of crowd you have. How much explaining before the poem do I do? And, well, I don't think I enunciate each word. I really try to slow down. That I have to make a conscious effort to do. And then a friend of mine once told me, you know, at the end of your sentences, you sort of fade off. You fade off. So, you know, there are some things that you just learn over time. But I try to make a really good effort to be in the moment with the readers and the crowd.
Well, to give this audience a taste of your poetry and how you perform it, would you mind reading us one now?
Love to. Awesome. So I think I will read the title poem of the book, which is the last poem I read in that I wrote in Mississippi called Glitter Road. And just a little aside, I didn't write any poetry. In the year that I was there, I was really trying to take in the landscape and get to know the people and settle my kids into a new high school. And so 7 months there, and we were just sort of getting to know things and exploring and taking notes, but not really writing poems. And then COVID hit in March 2020. And so we all went in hibernation. That's when I started to piece things together. I didn't have a full manuscript, but I did have the core of the poems. And so Glitter Road was the last poem really of the series. Glitter Road. I'll take my miracles however they appear these days. The salamander poking its head above the bricks. The shocking blue overcoat of the season's first bluebird. A spider web unbroken. At the corner of Molly Bar and McElroy, I saw a thick trail of glitter in the curve of the right turn lane. Fuchsia. Heavy shimmer refracting the noonday sun as if laying flat a rainbow's extracted hue. Not paint or blood or a parade shedding its cheer. It's the faded streak of eyeshadow as it trails into flecks, then disappears. I think of cars passing through this moment, their undercarriages aglow with possibility. Not hard to feel good riding a glistening wave, my tires now bespeckled with a purple sheen that's tough to rid or wash away, the road ahead made beautiful by this temporary shine.
January, that's gorgeous. That's gorgeous. It has been a delight to have you on this show. But before I let you go, tell me and everyone else how we can find you online. And more importantly, or is equally important, buy your book.
Oh, thank you. Well, you can find Glitter Road, published by Cabin Carry Press, with all of the major retailers, as well as going through the independent booksellers. It's available online and, you know, in bookstores. And where can I be found? I love Instagram. So you can find me there as well as whatever Twitter X is and Facebook. And I'm at januarygilloneal.com. So, and hopefully I'll see some of you on the road.
I wish that I could, and we need to get you to Georgia soon so that will happen. But until that does, January, all I can do is hope. But again, it has been fantastic to have you on the show. And as things develop in your career, life, or both, let me know. We'll have you right back on.
Ooh, will do. Will do. Thank you so much. This is great. Thanks, Clifford.
Yes, ma'am. It is a tremendous honor this evening to bring you the country singer and songwriter and new contestant on The Voice, Mr. Tay Lewis.
What he do?
It's amazing to have you on the show, man. How are you?
I'm good, bro. How are you?
I am fine and dandy like sour candy. The energy you bring is infectious, man. It's infectious. Man, we have a lot to talk about. We have plenty of time to do it, man.
Yes, sir.
Tell me, who are you and what makes you happy?
Man, well, I'm Tay Lewis, obviously. And what really makes me happy is just being around community and just being able to love and love on people and love on myself, for one. But that's what really makes me happy, is just really being able to love on my community and love on myself and just be able to show my heart to people. That's really what I love so much.
And the world at large, that's not even hyperbole. I mean, you on TV big time. I told the story. A quick aside, folks. When I got Tay Lewis's name, I thought in a million years, this can't be the same guy I just saw on television. And then I found out quickly thereafter, it is indeed the gentleman that I've seen on television. And what stuck and sticks you in my mind is the heart that you bring to the stage. And that's something I think you're born with and something that you have to hone over time. But I want to know how you see that. So let's begin at the beginning. How did you get your first interest in just music in general?
Yeah, so I grew up in the church. My dad is a pastor. I come from a long line of pastors, so I can't run from that at all, even if I tried. But, you know, from there, you know, I just kind of grew up around that, and then also grew up around a lot of, you know, rednecks as well. So I did. I grew up around rednecks. I did all the frog rigging and all that type of stuff like that. So I did a lot of those things. Let's just say that. Deer hunting and that's what I grew up on. And so they, you know, the rednecks, they really introduced me to country music. And so that's how I kind of got, you know, embraced into that. And then when I got to high school, after high school, I started just kind of really like developing a love so much of country music. And it's been amazing. I'm glad that I was introduced to it by some rednecks.
When you sit down to write songs, how do you channel the spirit of the music you've chosen? Like, how do you use country music to tell your story?
I think it's really about, like, you know, just being upfront and about, you know, who you are and being authentic. I was actually looking at an interview the other day, and Travis Tritt was talking about how country music is really about the authenticity that you bring in, like, the words that you talk about, the songwriting. And so if you don't really have a story, or if you haven't really gone through something, you can't really talk about what country music is, right? Mm-hmm. So that is what I bring to the table, is really just talking about the stories of what I've been through, the relationships, as well as, like, my experiences in being in country music, as well as just really just everything that I've learned in all of my experiences of life. I really hone into all of those things in country music. So
when you sit down to write, and I love, you know, as a poet, I love to hear about how songwriters do it too, because the marriage there is so close. What rituals do you go through? What kind of headspace do you need to be in to write a song?
Man, that's a good question. I for me, I mean, the headspace that I usually have is just really just being able to hone in to, like, to my inner self and my inner beings of what I'm, like, really going through in that moment. A lot of times those songs that you are going through, whatever you're going through in that moment, is really those dope songs that you have, right? So I think a lot of times people, when they write songs, they just write them to make it marketable. Obviously, those are great songs, but those songs that are, like, really carrying you through, and those things that you, like, are really, like, struggling with in those moments. Like, when I write with other writers with me, like, we talk about what we're going through. When, as soon as we walk in the room together, we talk about the things that we're going through, and we're like, man, maybe that is a song. And then we just kind of, like, battle it out and trying to figure out how we can be able to write it as a song. And so I think those are the most experiential, is that the word? Experiential type of songs that you can do that is going to really surface through people. Because the way that we live in this society now, people want transparency. They don't want the bullcrap, right? They want transparency. So I feel like in you being transparent with all the lyrics that you come up with and songs that you write, it's going to surface through to the people. So
You don't have to hide lies if you ain't got it.
Nah, you know? Bro. You know? You ain't got to hide it, dog. You know?
And there's not an ounce of any of the light that you carry with you. You imbue it. And in that, man, you see it on television. So, I mean, the heart, all the heartache, all the triumph, all the songwriting skill that you have in performance, which is on point, brings you to the voice, Team Reba. How did that happen and how does it feel?
Oh, man. It's crazy how I'm on Team Reba still. I'm still shocked about that. And she smells amazing, for one. Yo, she smells amazing, okay? Like, for real. Now, one thing that really shocked me is that this whole time, I thought that was Reba's hair, and it was not. It's been wigs this whole time. So it really was like, what is happening, right? So, but she is amazing. She's an amazing person. She is like a mom, a second mom, a mom that I needed during this whole experience. And so I think a lot of times, like, you know, when you get in productions and doing reality shows, you need somebody that's going to actually hone in and help you to realize, like, okay, this is what's happening. And Reba is that type of person, right? She's the way that she is on TV is the exact way that she is off camera, you know? So that's what I love so much about her.
So, I mean, to get on that show, man, you have an uncompromising air about you. For those who would like to follow in your footsteps, when you got up to grind, what kept you going?
Man, that is a good question. I think one of the biggest, and I was talking to one of my friends about this last night. One of my biggest things of what kept me going was knowing that I don't want to come back home being broke.
Yeah.
As an artist, right? Because as an artist, we're struggling all the time, right? And so I'm just going to be real transparent about it. It's like, I didn't want to go back home and being broke. So for me, I had to duke it out the whole time. I had to really fight for the journey and fight for like what I wanted. And that was to really get that recording contract, right? So in my mind, I was just like, listen, I'm here for business, but I'm also here to make sure that I'm doing a great and exceptional job to be able to keep moving in within the career of The Voice. So I can be able to get that recording contract and $100,000, right? And I can do this full time and don't have to worry about figuring out where I can be able to get my money from. Because what people don't talk about is that we as artists, we're always trying to figure out where the money is going to come from. So I don't want to have to keep doing that, right? I don't want to have to come home and struggle all the time. So
best
that
answer.
That's what helped me to keep grinding, bro.
Best answer ever. Best answer ever. I'd like to get paid. Ding, 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 ding. Interview over. Man, in that grind, man, you have it on stage and off. Tell us about the projects you have on deck coming up.
Yeah, bro. So I got an EP that's going to come out after the show is done. We got a couple singles that's ready to be locked and loaded. I'm working on talking to my manager here to try to figure out if I can re-release a song that I have out that we've been talking to in regards to track, because I was a Tractor Supply emerging artist. And so we re-recorded a song. And so I'm going to be talking to my manager to see if we can be able to get that song out because it was done before the show started. So obviously there's like so much of like legality that happens where we can't really post about music and stuff like that until after the show is done, right? Because it's the cross paths that we have that goes through. But we got an EP coming out. We got a single that's going to be coming out, you know, a couple singles after that. And that's it, man. And then working on some other shows. We're trying to get a summer tour together right now. So after the show, we can just start heading out to the spots that's been actually watching me on the show as well. So we got a couple spots, dog.
Well, I'm gonna take one of those spots. So I'm gonna hold you to the fire. We talked before the show about a song called "Dear Me," and we're gonna play it right after I get off the phone with you, but before I do, give us the backstory, the storyteller's portion of the show, as it were.
Yeah, so I wrote this song with my friend Steve Musso, who's a worship pastor in New York. And the song talks about just the struggles of being an artist and really never giving up on who you are and what your dreams are. Even if it takes 10, 20 years, just really talking to yourself and telling yourself to never give up on what you got, what you want to do, and what God's called you to do. So,
hey, the embrace you have your life and the unflinching love you have for it, I want to have some of that in my life. I hope one day to grow up to be you, Tay. That's my drive, to grow up and be you, man.
Bro, wow.
One last note to the folks. Tell us how to keep up with you online and how to buy your music.
Yeah, if you want to buy my music, please buy my music, okay? Because every time that you buy the music on Apple Music or iTunes, it goes to me, okay? So so buy it on Google Play, buy it on iTunes, get it from Spotify, wherever. That's wherever you stream music or wherever you buy music, just go and get it from there. It's under Tay Lewis, T-A-E-L-E-W-I-S.
Right on, boss. Well, Tay Lewis, songwriter and legend, it has been amazing to have you on this show. And as your career develops, I promise and I hope that you won't forget me.
Bro, I ain't gonna forget you. Come on now.
All right, man. We'll see you soon now.
All right, brother.
Now let's take a break to hear more from Tay Lewis with this song, Lot to Drink Over.
Cause it's the weekend, me and my friends gonna hit some low places at the dive bar. And we ain't worried about work on Monday. And those bills gonna get paid someday. Cause right now we gon' celebrate our way. So cheers to another sunrise. One more day, 23rd in the sky. Sipping that shine in a solo cup. Half past four, keep filling it up. So pour the good stuff today. Goodbye. I got some garbage spinning on the jukebox. We gon' sing along till the lights turn off. Got a room full of ladies and some 2-for-1 beers. I can't complain about a thing right here. Let's cheers to another sunrise. One more day, 23rd in the sky. Sipping that shine in a solo cup. Half past four, keep feeling it up.
Dante's doesn't get a lot of fresh voices on the show, but we definitely do tonight. We have retired teacher, poet, and editor Robert Padrilla. How are you doing, Robert?
Good, man. Good to talk to you.
Well, it's fun to have you on. You've been a student of mine for about 3 years, and we're working on a book that you'll be talking about later. But my audience doesn't know anything about you. So please give us some of the highlights of your story, boss.
Okay. Well, let's see. I kind of grew up down on the Jersey Shore in the 50s, back when it was kind of barren and a lot of dune grass and cattails and empty lots and gravel roads. And, you know, we all have those memories of, the way Eden was before it got corrupted. So that, I suppose, was kind of formative for me because, I was a lot of time, alone. I mean, I had friends and we hung out, but there wasn't like a lot going on. There was always the beach and the bay and lots of time and nature. And I never thought much of it. I just kind of tried to get through each day at school and come home and, not have my parents rag on me and whatever. And but that was probably pretty fundamental. I still have a lot of those memories are, as they are with anyone, deeply embedded. And I find that stuff comes out in my dreams. It comes out in places in my poetry, if not an entire poem, certainly fragments, underlying structures. So that's where I was. That's where I started out down there, and I lived there until I was in my early 20s, and then I took off. I started traveling. I hitchhiked across the U.S. I was 20 years old, and hitchhiked out to Oregon, down the West Coast, into Mexico, back up. Saw some friends in Colorado and stayed a while. And then came back east and got a little place, my first solo place. I had apartments with friends. And I had met a lot of people along the way hitchhiking. Interestingly, a lot of teachers. Now, I was 20, so they were probably 30, 40 men, mostly men. But I met some women along the way. And among a lot of these people, this was 1970, and they were into, meditation and stuff that I'd never heard of. And I came back home and, bought a bunch of books and spent a lot of time just getting in touch with myself. And so those were pretty formative years there for a while. I traveled again. I went overseas. I got as far as Nepal, Kathmandu. I did the kind of trek that so many people do. It's several poems in my new book, only book, are devoted to that subject and some of the things that I experienced there. When I got back from that, did a little more hanging around. I did a lot of carpentry work. And then eventually I moved from New Jersey up to the state of Maine. And I've been here since 1974. So it's been 50 years now. I've been up here in my new home. And in that time, I did all kinds of things, more work, went back to university because I started right after high school, dropped out for about 8 years. Like I say, worked and traveled, spent a lot of idle time. And then went back to university up here in Maine. Got a degree in English and ended up in a classroom. And that's where I stayed for pretty much the next 35 years. So I ended up being a high school English teacher. And by and large, I loved it. There were days when I hated it. But, it was a worthwhile experience. And during that time, I married, raised two daughters, both of whom I still see regularly. I've been retired now about 10 years. And in that time, I've devoted a lot of time to poetry. I kind of picked up poetry just before I started teaching. I had back in the early 80s, I was kind of in between things. Had graduated from college after my second go round, and just had this old Underwood typewriter that I'd gotten somewhere at a yard sale, one of those, you know, Hemingway models. and I would sit there and click and clack and ding, return the carriage, and had a ball. And I just wrote pages and pages of stuff. And some of it was poetry. I didn't know what I was doing. But once I started teaching and started teaching English, of course, I got immersed in all that. And I think that's where I picked up a lot of my style, my stylistic leanings, and particularly my reliance on blank verse or sonnets, iambic pentameter. It just comes natural to me. So that's a long answer.
It's a perfectly long answer, and it answered my second question: why you got into poetry? That was a perfect midlife story. But what I want to springboard off of is that you mentioned sonnets at the very end, and I won't go off too much script as far as I'm not a fan of sonnets by and large, and I worked with you for quite some time before I realized that the eloquence and the beauty of the sonnet that you did, I wasn't able to detect it at first, to read and to do it being a sonnet. You do sonnets extraordinarily well. Tell the audience what drew you to the sonnet and how you became so eloquent with it.
Well, I guess it started, you know, with English classes, teaching it and reading it. Of course, I was an English major, so, you know, I'd had years of immersion in English literature, the Elizabethans, the Victorians, you know, the Romantics, all that. And, you know, it just kind of always seemed like a form that appealed to me because of its conciseness. It required the writer to express something in 14 lines. And to furthermore, if you're going to really, you know, follow it by the form, to kind of set it up in a particular way, you know, a thesis, a antithesis, a synthesis, and then a conclusion, which not any all sonnets have to follow, but it is one of the underlying structures. And it just seemed to me, mathematicians use the word elegant for a very simple way of expressing a, you know, mathematical formula. And it seems to me a very elegant way to probe some of the themes that writers, the poets explore. So I, of course, Shakespeare, and then, all the rest of them, the Romantics, the Americans, Frost, to some extent, Edward Arlington Robinson, you know, up here from Tilbury Town. That's Gardner, Maine, by the way. I discovered Edna St. Vincent Millay. And she was an epiphany because, Shakespeare, right? But, you know, you get past that language, you know, same thing, John Donne or, you know, any of them. You get past the language, you get very familiar with it and you get it, but it's still a little convoluted. And it's, I don't know, it's, you know, there are some barriers. But then you get to Edna Millay and it's, she can sometimes lapse back into that archaic form of language, the thous and things, but you know, her content and her tone, you know, the way she took on, you know, these lovers and just like, you know, decimated them when things didn't work out or if she thought they were being whatever. She'd get in the last word and, kind of reminds me of Taylor Swift. You know? Yes. It's like, okay, dude, if this doesn't work out, you know there's going to be a sonnet written about you.
Well, when you sit down to write anything, tell me about your process. Is there some sort of ritual you go through or time of day? What's that look like for you?
No, Not at all. I've tried it, I think, on occasion. Never works for me. I'll wake up and I'll sit on the edge of the bed and I'll think about something or nothing or whatever. And you know, I might have an idea, or it might be something that I'd heard, a snippet of dialogue, conversation with a friend or something somewhere. And a thought, and it'll, you know, I'll roll it around in my head for a few days, just kind of thinking about it, and then, you know, let it go. And then who knows, you know, a week, maybe a month later, there's like more of the kernel is kind of sprouted. Right. And now there's something there that might root. And generally, if I get a first line, if I get a way to start it, I'll come in, I'll sit down, and I used to do a lot of longhand on legal yellow pads, but now I sit to my laptop, and I'll get that first line out there. And depending on how it shapes up, that'll tell me whether it's going to be just a free form, you know, kind of line lengths, sort of the language, the tone. And if it comes out in, you know, lines of, you know, a blank verse or iambic pentameter, then I know, okay, this is feeling like it wants to be. And depending what it is, I can kind of shape it if I can narrow it down to about 14. Otherwise, sometimes it's just a ramble. Anyway, that's how it usually starts. And I have found that I have tried on numerous occasions to sit down and write something because I want to write a poem about this. And those is, I'm sure you know this, but those are dismal failures most of the time. You know, you put them aside and sometimes you come back on. But occasionally, you know, you get something you can work with. And I wait for it to come to me more often than not. And when it's ready, I know it. And I can usually go with it. And I'll blast out a first draft. Sometimes I won't even know what happened, and 15 minutes later I'm looking at a page of something. And then, to lead into your next question, mm-hmm. I suppose the editing process, that's where you know, I'll set it aside, or maybe I'll, if I feel really, really, really good about it, I might share it. You know, I've had a few people close to me that, you know, would be my first readers, and I've got some small groups that I work with. And eventually, you know, they'll see it. I'll take those comments under advisement. And sometimes I put it aside for weeks or months, sometimes only just a few days, and I can just keep coming back to it and get it the way I think I want it. And then I'll show it to somebody like yourself, mm-hmm. someone who, you know, whose opinion I absolutely, you know, trust as a professional, as an artist, and who's just not going to give me, you know, something I don't need, not going to just give me some useless, empty praise, and is going to tell me, well, you know, whatever. And so I never know. I never know exactly, but I don't have a methodical approach, at least not one that works consistently.
Well, we've methodically made it to the part of the show where we talk about your book that comes out. Tell us the title of it and what makes it so important to you.
The title of it was fairly easy to come up with. It's What Passes for a Life. And the reason I'm calling it that is because it's purports to be a close autobiographical rendering of these experiences I've just been sharing with you. I'm growing up down there on the Jersey Shore, and my parents, my family, my friends, some of the, you know, experiences I had as a you know, young man, and how, to me, obviously, to anyone really, you know, those are formative, and I've just been lucky enough to hold on to those memories pretty clearly. And once I started writing, more regularly, particularly in the last 10 years, they became a focus for me of stories, really. Stories that I wanted to tell, stories that are sometimes in sonnet form, sometimes in, I wouldn't call them ballads, but just rambles, I guess, that are, as much narrative as lyrical, and that are attempts to tell what the meaningful experiences that I've had have been like. Always my goal is, if I'm going to tell you something, if I'm going to write something, that I hope that you'll read it, I want you to be able to feel what it is that I was feeling when that was happening, and to come away with something, some thought of your own, some feeling that was awakened or triggered or remembered. And if it's a completely new experience, like I've got some poems in there on cancer that, and not everyone has been fortunate enough to have, unfortunate enough to have a bout of cancer. And I know whenever I come across stuff, I read things, people's experiences that I can't imagine. And then I read their work and I end up, weeping, thinking about how it must feel to be a mother and lose a child, for instance. And if I can convey in any way some bit of what I have felt in my life experiences and leave that with someone, then I feel like, my life might have been worthwhile. And whatever passes for a life, and I have some different views on that. I like to think that that might be one of the more important parts of it.
Well, we're going to get a piece of it now, not just any poem, but a sonnet from you that might be the coda of this collection. Would you please give us some of the background on it and then read it for us?
Sure. let me pull it up here, Jen. Recently, since I've retired up here at the University of Southern Maine, they have a program. It actually started here. It's a nationwide program called, informally, it's called Senior College. It's affiliated with OLLI, O-L-L-I, the Osher family, Bernard Osher and his wife. They were philanthropists who had a connection up here to Maine, and they started this this program, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. So it's basically a bunch of people over 50 who meet in classrooms at the university in the off hours, and someone leads a class and something that has been their lifelong passion, and people sign up for it. It's cheap. It's fun. It's all volunteer. And so I joined a poetry group there, and have been writing in that group with some folks, as well as some others, for the last few years. And one of the classes I took this fall from, or this past winter at the senior college, was called Swedish Death Cleaning. And you may have heard something about it. It's like one of these Marie Kondo kind of things where Japanese, every culture has some aspect of this where you get to a certain point and you think, okay, who's going to clean up all this crap when when I'm gone? They're going to walk in and say, what? I don't want this stuff. So the idea is to kind of make ready. And so it's been a great course. Wonderful people. Funny stories. Everyone's making progress, bringing stuff to, consignment style shops or, Goodwill or donating to, the immigrant families who are in dire need of all of these, household goods and clothing. So I woke up one morning and I sat on the edge of the bed, as I'm wont to do these days before I get up. And this is the thought that occurred to me, the first one. the first couple lines, and I came in here and I wrote it down in one fell swoop, revised it a couple places. But this is called Memento Mori, Someday. You know that term, right? Latin, Memento Mori. It's either a remembrance or something that, you know, just a token or a image or just a reminder. Mm-hmm. It literally means remember.
Yeah, we're all going to die.
You will die.
Yeah.
Memento Mori, Someday is the title. I woke up this morning and thought about dying. It's not that I plan to, not soon at least, but lately my mortality is trying to usher out this lifelong lively feast. Oh, sure, it's not always been so tasty. The bitter scraps I've had to swallow fast, the hungry hours are savorless and pasty. The company I've kept that didn't last. There comes a time when all of it must cease, when sweetness cloys and appetite is sated. We're left to sit among the bones in peace, once relished flavors now dissipated. It's in this lightened mood that I begin to contemplate my breakfast once again.
That's a really good poem. That's really good. Robert Petrillo, it has been a treat to have you on the show. Your book comes out this late spring, early summer. And as soon as it does, we'll have you back on the show. And if folks want to know even more about you, they'll be able to read about you in the Blue Mountain Review coming out in April with Billy Bob Thornton on the cover. Robert, it's been a fantastic time having you on the show.
Clifford, always a pleasure, man.
Well, folks, another hour has come and gone with Dante's Old South. I'm your host, Clifford Brooks, and this has been an honor to share this hour with you. Before I let y'all go, let me thank again Lucid House Publishing, The Crown Restaurant, Mercer University Press, UCLA Writers Extension Program, NPR and WUTC, Richard Wynn and Michael Amade, and The Red Phone Booth. Y'all, thank you for spending this time with me. I appreciate it every month you come and sit down. Y'all be good to one another. Keep the hope and keep the faith. Good night.